New York City's Bellevue Hospital is the nation's oldest public hospital and serves patients from all over the world. Dr. Danielle Ofri, an attending physician there, has recently published a book documenting her experience working with immigrant patients. It's called Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients, and it's published by Beacon Press. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Ofri to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
I've heard that the top medical school graduates prefer to do their internships at hospitals like Bellevue and Kings County because they see every kind of medical condition there.
That's probably true. I think one of the other reasons that medical students are drawn to public hospitals is because they get a lot of autonomy and a chance to meet patients from all walks of life with all types of illnesses.
Did medical school prepare you for some of the patients that you treat?
Well, I went to medical school at NYU, so I did most of my clinical clerkships at Bellevue, so I was, in fact, quite well prepared.
For undocumented patients, survivors of torture?
That was new for me as an attending. I really didn't deal with that so much as a student, but that was quite a different experience.
Mm. And is that something you could even prepare for?
I don't think so.
This is your third book about your experiences as a doctor. Do the two pursuits complement each other?
Well, in some ways, doctors, especially internists, pay close attention to details of patients. Even when they just walk in the room, our exam begins observing the way they walk and talk, smell, dress. And these are similar aspects to what novelists do, paying attention to voice and character, and helps us make our diagnosis.
Because I've been thinking about some of the doctors who become writers, more famous ones, Chekhov and William Carlos Williams, but more recently, some pretty good ones, Atul Gawande, Jerome Groopman, and there probably are lots of others. Was your first love writing or medicine?
I would say it was both. I've always been a book lover. In medicine, when we present a case history, we're really telling a story of a patient. There's a character, there's a plot, a drama, and tension. So it's very similar to the way a novel or fiction works.
Although we hope you're not being creative when you're doing that.
No, not at all. But each time we present the history of the present illness, we're telling the story of this patient.
What are the demographics at Bellevue, both of the patients and of the doctors, the staff, and administration?
Well, the patient population, in terms of where they come from, country of origin, reflects in many ways the ways of immigration to America and through the portal of New York City. So over the generations, there have been the waves of European, German, Jewish, Irish immigrants, now Asian, Southeast Asian. The medical staff is actually quite diverse, too, although it's about a step behind that of the patients. So our medical staff is diversifying, but not quite as fast as the patient population.
But so is there a certain amount of cultural gap? Obviously, there is an educational gap in many cases. But at Bellevue, you see rich and poor, don't you? Anybody who an ambulance picks up.
That's true. Really, anyone can come in. There are certainly cultural gaps. There are languages that people have never heard of, countries that don't quite make it on the map, languages, illnesses that we haven't seen before. So there can be quite a few gaps.
So how do you get over that? If somebody comes in who only speaks a language that nobody even recognizes?
Well, there's a number of creative ways. Often if they can bring a family member. I had a patient who spoke Fulani, a West African language, and there are interpreters, but we happened to not be able to find anyone available. I went on Google, found a Fulani center in Brooklyn, called and found the secretary, and they interpreted for us.
Over the phone?
Over the phone.
Is this different than other hospitals you've worked at, which probably had more homogeneous makeups?
Certainly. When 98% of your patients speak English, you don't even think of language as a challenge. Although if you think carefully, when someone becomes ill, even if they speak English, they're entering a new culture, and there's a language of medicine that is foreign, new mores, new dress, new practices. So even when you speak the language, you might need an interpreter for that culture of medicine.
What percentage of your patients are immigrants?
Oh, I would say the vast majority. Probably I speak solid English 30% of my day, Spanish 30%, and the other third of the time I'm using interpreters for other languages.
And would you assume that many of them are undocumented?
Quite a few are. I don't ask. Nobody asks. But I think many are.
Because, you know, I guarantee you I'm going to get some mail from people who are saying we should not be treating undocumented immigrants.
Well, there's a tension between what we make policy as a society and then what we do as individual physicians. When a patient comes to you ill, it's really not relevant, and it can't be relevant, and both on a humane level, a professional level, ethical level. This is the patient you're taking care of.
But I assume all of them have no insurance.
Some people have insurance, Medicaid, managed care, but many don't. And they're even, quote, Native Americans without insurance. People who've lost their job have lost their insurance. We have many working class, middle class patients who no longer have health insurance due to the economic climate.
Well, it has also been pointed out that the emergency rooms of our public hospitals are the only doctors that many people, poor people, have.
That's true. We're trying very hard to change that, which is why our clinic is so large, and we don't make issues about where patients are from or their immigrant status. We would much rather give primary care on a preventative basis than treat someone in the emergency room.
When did you first start working at Bellevue?
Oh, I started medical school in 1986, and I've been there essentially ever since. I took some time off to travel and work in a few other places, but basically I've been at Bellevue all my professional life.
Is it the sort of thing where you just apply for a position there as you would with any other job?
Oh, yes, and it's actually quite difficult to get a job. It's very much in demand to be a doctor at Bellevue. People love working with diverse populations. They also love working with the staff that's committed to working with interesting and more challenged populations.
So did you choose to work with immigrant patients?
Well, I chose to work at Bellevue. After residency, I took some time off, and I did some locum tenens, which is temporary work for doctors. So I had a chance to work in private practice, small hospitals, community hospital, and I very much, although I enjoy them, wanted to come back to Bellevue because of the interesting and interested staff and patients there.
Well, you mentioned that the staff is just one step behind the patients as far as they're coming to America. We see Indian doctors. An immigrant or were your family from another country?
I was born here. My father's from Israel. My mother's family's from Eastern Europe.
So do you feel some kind of connection?
Oh, absolutely. I know the story of my father, my grandparents on both sides, coming to America and being foreigners, not speaking English, and I appreciate how confusing that can be.
My guest is Danielle Ofri, O-F-R-I. Her latest book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients, is published by Beacon. We mentioned working with people who are victims of torture. When did you start doing that?
Well, one of my colleagues, Alan Keller, founded this program for survivors of torture several years ago.
And he's been on our show, in fact, to talk about it.
And so we serve patients who are seeking political asylum and try to address their many needs, legal, psychological, medical. And so a number of us general doctors see the patients for their medical needs. So once a week I see a new patient and try to address their medical issues relating to their torture.
Are their issues usually more physical or more mental?
They tend to be psychological. Most of these patients have been involved in opposition politics, which tends to attract the young and the healthy college student or young worker. So many often, although some do have serious physical ailments from their torture, mostly it's issues of psychiatric and readjusting to society.
Although I'm assuming some people actually need bones reset and things like that.
By the time they see us, some time has often passed, but there are many who need continued surgeries and physical therapy.
Are most of them seeking political asylum?
Most are seeking political asylum. But some are also just needing the support of being with other people who've been through what they've been through.
There actually was an increase in people seeking political assignment in the 80s and 90s, wasn't there?
There seems to always be an increase. The sort of the need for the program keeps growing and growing, which reflects just the turmoil in most countries, in many countries abroad that we, you know, have the privilege of not seeing here.
I would assume some of them are rather suspicious of anyone. Does it take a bit of work to get them to relax and actually talk about the horrific things that they've experienced?
Certainly on the first visit, many don't want to talk about it. There are many flashbacks and nightmares, and anyone in uniform or in any position of an administration or authority can be suspicious. People have been taken advantage of by doctors before and policemen and government officials, so it can take some time.
Well, is there a problem in general in connecting with the patients that you see?
It varies. Many patients, surprisingly, are quite optimistic, and you'd think that once you've been through such severe torture that optimism wouldn't be one of those emotions. But I think people who are drawn to political opposition are often have strong emotional resilience and real optimism. So I'm continually impressed more than I am depressed about these patients.
Well, we talked about language barriers, but what about the cultural barriers? I would think that, first of all, you're a woman.
That's common.
And I'm sure that there are some people who are uncomfortable being treated by a woman, no matter what the illness.
That's rare. Occasionally, religious, either Muslims or Orthodox Jews, might be uncomfortable, but it's actually almost unheard of.
Really?
In my experience.
Because the need is so great, they just will put their trust in you?
I think that it doesn't cross most people's minds, honestly, in this day and age.
What about your side? People come in, they come from different cultural background. Do you ever find yourself having to overcome some of your preconceptions?
Well, certainly. I had an issue, which I wrote about in the book, of one of my patients with a full veil. And my issues about the veil, political issues, what I thought might be subjugation of women. It took me years to overcome my own concerns about that, and with her daughter with the veil, until I got a chance to really know her. And then I really learned quite a bit about the veil and her, that she didn't see the subjugation at all. For her, it was a sign of her independence and her own choices.
Mm-hmm. Which is what women who wear the veil generally will tell you. Then it's up to us to decide whether we think that that's a reasonable explanation or not. That's where the cultural differences occur.
Right. I find that I learn so much. The reason I titled this Journeys with My Patients, I feel as though I go on these journeys with my patients and learn about cultures that I really wouldn't know about other than in the news, which is, you know, quite skewed.
Is religion ever an issue for the patients? Do they ever ask you what
your
religion
is? Yes. Quite commonly, in fact. A lot of my patients are Hispanic, Catholic patients, tend to know that I'm Jewish. They know the clinic calms down in Rosh Hashanah. But many of my Muslim patients ask me point blank because they're interested in thinking that I'm a little bit Semitic looking and find it a point of commonality than difference.
Really? So the all of the conflicts of other parts of the world fly out the door when you need medical help.
Well, I think for one thing, we're in New York and not in Riyadh, and that may make a difference that we're not in a place where the political tensions are so violent. But also, people are here that are in need and don't feel the polarization.
My guest is Danielle Ofri, O-F-R-I. Her latest book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients, is published by Beacon. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in the show, we'll take a look at the disappearing art of letter writing and the many ways we've communicated through the mails, from letters home written by soldiers at war to fan mail. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC is supported by Penguin Books, publisher of Revelation by C.J. Sansom. The fourth installment in the Matthew Shardlake mystery series is a historical thriller set in Tudor England. Revelation, now in paperback. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, presenting Playing with Pictures, whimsical, rarely seen photo collages of watercolor drawings and photographic portraits created by aristocratic women of the Victorian age for the delight of their intimate society. Preview at metmuseum.org. Next fall, now on Broadway, Elton John and David Furnish present this new American play by Jeffrey Knopfs about falling in love with someone who's different than you. Next fall is directed by Cheryl Coller. Tickets available at telecharge.com.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez. If you're a New Yorker and have an ounce of culture, you know who Leonard Lopate is. Join me to celebrate the great Lopate with artist Chuck Close, pianist Jace Moran, and lots of others for a night of music, memories, and mockery, a Leonard Lopate 25th anniversary roast, Thursday, March 25th at the Cooper Union. Tickets available on the events page at WNYC.org.
We're back with Danielle Ofri, who's an attending physician at Bellevue Hospital and the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Bellevue Literary Review. Her work has been published in Best American Essays, Best American Science Writing, The New York Times, The LA Times, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, etc., etc. And her latest book is called Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients. It's published by Beacon. We were talking about the problems sometimes of getting patients to open up to you, but you say that a lot of patients tell you things whether you're asking them or not. They really open up.
Well, I think that many people are primed in a doctor's office to be more revealing than they would be normally. they feel somehow more trusting that they're in a safe environment. And I think it is a more safe environment.
Was it your interactions with so many other cultures that made you decide to relocate for a time in Costa Rica?
Yes. I've always wanted to live abroad. I never had the chance to live in a different country. And also for me, Spanish is really the lingua franca in my clinic. So I use it, and I'm not that good at it. So I wanted to live in another country. So we decided to take this year abroad.
And did you expect to see yourself on the other side? You'd be the immigrant there.
Right. I also didn't expect to find myself the patient there. After we planned the trip, then I discovered that I was pregnant with my third child. And we decided to go forth and have our baby in another country. And it was ultimately a wonderful experience. But it was interesting to be on the other side of the stethoscope of having to communicate in not your native language.
At one point, you called Bellevue from a hospital in Costa Rica for medical advice for your son.
Yes, about a third or fourth day we were there, my 2.5-year-old son put some tropical seed up his nose and we couldn't get it out. And I realized that I didn't know where a hospital was. I didn't know if 911 existed. I didn't know anyone or anything. So I called Bellevue and I asked them how to get a seed out of the nose.
But you're not supposed to treat your own child, are you?
Right, but I didn't have a car or cell phone. I was desperate.
Did living in Costa Rica and getting medical care there change the way you viewed your job in the United States?
Very much so. I remember the most challenging experiences was when I took my son eventually to an emergency room, was filling out the forms. Standard forms, but in a foreign language, I couldn't figure out what all the details meant, and it would seem to take such a long time, and they were getting frustrated, and I was getting anxious. I wanted to get to a doctor, not spend time at a registration area.
Often, Americans are surprised by the quality of health care in other countries. I mean, my feeling is if I ever have to get sick suddenly, I want to be in France.
And I would say if I ever had to have a baby again, I would do it in Costa Rica.
Really?
Again.
They were that good?
Not only was the medical care good, but the whole society views children and families in a different way. And people were helpful in a way that I could never have imagined in America and made it so much easier.
A listener wants to know what your feelings are about a public option or single-payer health care.
Well, from the practitioner's point of view, especially in the trenches of a large public hospital, it just seems obvious that we should be having a single-payer for insurance. I don't understand how our country goes on without having medical care as a right for everyone, and it seems as though a public option would be beneficial or going straight to a single-payer plan.
Well, but yet there are so many people who are claiming that we still have the best system in the world and that if we had any changes, there are people in Congress who are suggesting any changes, would just mess everything up.
Until you lose your job, then the system's not so good anymore.
Did you miss practicing medicine when you were in Costa Rica?
Yes and no. I missed my patients. I missed my colleagues. But I really enjoyed having a break from medicine. I had a chance to do other things, write, play music, slow down a bit. And I realized how much stress there is in the lives we lead in New York City and that not having it for a year was like losing 20 pounds.
Well, they do say that being a doctor is a calling. But there was nobody calling you at that moment?
I knew I would be back. I couldn't leave it forever. But taking a break, I thought, was very important.
And when you came back, did you find yourself practicing medicine a little differently?
There was a lag of time where the relaxed life of Costa Rica stayed with me, and I tried very hard to hold on to it, but it's like a tidal wave in New York in a big city hospital. And within months, it was back to the same chaos, and I sort of mourn the loss of that slow-paced life.
We mentioned earlier that some of the patients you write about become very open with you. Does knowing more than just the medical situation help in the treatment?
Almost always, yes, because the medical illness is within a context. So a simple thing, someone has a wound that needs dressing. Well, if they're living on the street or living alone or don't have money, they're not able to do it. And if we don't know that part of their lives, then we really can't help them with their illness. But even in the larger scheme of things, we have to know if someone's suffering from depression or fear of people in authority, that would really impact their medical care.
You tell some really interesting stories here. You want to tell the story about the Tibetan patient?
Once we were working in the hospital when the anniversary, I think the 50th or 60th anniversary of the United Nations, and a Tibetan hunger striker was brought in against his will. But there was no one who spoke Tibetan, and we couldn't get an interpreter, and he was refusing treatment, and he was rather sick, hypotensive. His heart rate was very fast, and no matter what we did, he would not allow an IV. He kept pulling them out. And I was worried about this guy, and we couldn't communicate. And he was as though he was in a bubble in the middle of the emergency room. Finally, someone found a nurse aide in pediatrics who was from Tibet. And her speaking with him, not even talking about the medical issues at all, just connecting with him and the language about his country, enabled him to relax and accept treatment.
What happens when a patient or the parents of a patient refuse medical treatment? Somebody is brought into the hospital, but then for religious reasons, they would prefer you not to do it. Is it unethical to not treat them?
Well, it depends. It's on a case-by-case basis. But that's also when it's very important to understand someone's cultural context. What are the reasons for refusing? In some cultures, you know, illness doesn't exist unless there's a visible wound. So exploring what does that mean? Some people don't understand a disease like cancer or hypertension, which don't have visible symptoms. There's some communities in which the elders make the decision. So often understanding that can help us overcome those barriers and help the person get treatment.
You're the co-founder, as I mentioned earlier, of the Bellevue Literary Review. Are there a lot of doctors writing at Bellevue?
There are a few, although the Bellevue Literary Review, interestingly, publishes only a few health professionals. Mostly it's writers, ordinary people who've had experiences with illness and use poetry, fiction, and nonfiction to examine this.
Do you ever wind up with a patient whose name you recognize because he or she is a writer?
Not yet, but I'm still waiting.
So is there something about hospitals in Bellevue in particular that makes good material for stories? Or could this just as easily have been called the Kings County Literary Review?
Well, I think that public hospitals that serve such a large and diverse population are home to so many different types of stories. I often think about the ghosts of Bellevue. Since 1736, generations have come through the halls, and their stories and their cultures come through. So it seemed like a fitting place to start a literary journal.
Mm-hmm. Because of the diversity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you publishing only English-speaking writers?
We have published a work in translation, but it's in English. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bellevue, actually, it's an apt name, isn't it? Because the windows look out, at least in some of the wards, to a very beautiful view of the East River. Is that distracting at all?
I think it's enlightening. I mean, our doctor's offices are in the windowless interior, but the patient's rooms have beautiful sun-filled windows, and I think that's a real part of healing, is having the chance to have sunlight in the outside, you know, share your space.
Well, we're in a radio studio that actually has access to the outside. It's very rare in this business, and I feel that it affects what I do and how my guests respond.
Once in a while, I've helped a patient go outside into the garden just for a few minutes, because I think it really changes how they're feeling and how their care is going.
What about the bad reputation Bellevue has had in all the old movies and some of the sensationalized news stories?
I think that's just a stereotype. And anyone who's ever been to Bellevue, first of all, it's a physically beautiful building now, and the facilities are quite modern and up-to-date, and the care is excellent. When my son was hit by a bicycle recently, I brought him to Bellevue, and I felt so validated with his care.
Mm-hmm. What would you like to see come out of the healthcare debate? Obviously, we're not going to get single payer, and there's a good chance that immigrants, the kind of people that you treat the most, are going to be excluded from any plans.
Well, any change that looks at healthcare more as something that everyone should be having, even if we don't get to the absolute everyone, I think is progress. And the fact that the people who are losing their jobs and coming to our clinic because they've lost their insurance can now have coverage is a step forward. It's not perfect, but it's a small step.
Well, it is interesting that you're a doctor and you have to think about political things, which should be irrelevant.
They should be. And I think in the day-to-day functioning, most of us block that out because we can't let it impact our care. Yet it's a reality because it does impact our patients' lives so much.
In writing down some of these stories about the various people that you've treated, were there privacy concerns? I know that when psychiatrists have written books, they have wound up changing the story so much to protect their patients that it actually winds up being something totally different.
Well, I think I always change names and some details. But for this book, when I try to obtain consent, some of my patients I've been very forthright and asked if I could interview them outside the hospital. But for everyone for whom I could obtain consent, I do.
And are you planning to write more books of this sort? Are you running out of material? Because you pretty much written about all the interesting patients you've had.
You know, every day there are new and interesting patients and issues that arise that I think can help edify the debate on healthcare and training of future doctors.
Do you ever bump into, this is such a big city, you ever bump into your former patients on the street?
Once in a while, not too often.
And would you ever go into private practice, or is the hospital the only environment for you?
I think that Bellevue is where I want to be. It's where I feel the happiest, and I think I'll stay there.
You were rather discreet there. One of your neighbors is a former patient, isn't that true?
That's true. Because I live in the neighborhood of Bellevue, I do occasionally run into patients on the street, and it's usually very pleasant.
Daniel Ofri will be speaking and signing books tomorrow. Tomorrow morning, in fact, at 10:30 at the Kipps Bay branch of the New York Public Library. That's at 3rd Avenue at 31st Street. The book, Medicine in Translation, Journeys with My Patients, is published by Beacon. And I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's been really fascinating. And keep on doing the good work. By the way, there's more information about what she's doing on our show page at wnyc.org.
Thank you.